Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
When Sweet Tarts dared to combine sweet and tart, they thought, why stop there? Why not create other exciting and unexpected combinations, like rainbows and ropes, or fruity and gummy, or chewy and more chewy? That's why they created fun treats like Sweet Tarts Twisted Rainbow Ropes, Gummies Fruity Splits, and Chewy Fusions. When you dare to combine, it's sure to blow your mind. Sweet Tarts, dare to combine. Visit SweetTartsCandy.com to shop now.
This episode is brought to you by Dove. You use all the right skincare products for your face, but your body has been missing out. With new Dove Serum Body Wash, you can give your body the vitamin C glow it's been wanting, the hydration boost it's been craving, and the active skincare ingredients it deserves. It's time for your body care era. New Dove Serum Body Wash. Get Dove or get FOMO.
Welcome to the Good Food Podcast. In this episode, food writer and TV presenter Donal Skean joins me, Good Food's podcast editor Samuel Goldsmith, to discuss his new book, as well as classic Irish ingredients and the food scene in LA.
You find your LA bubble, and when you find your LA bubble, you'll find that there's restaurants, there's people, there's interesting aspects to it. And I think it's very much it's not a centralised city in the way that we might think of Dublin or London. And the amazing thing is, from a food perspective, is that there is just this incredible amount of different cuisines to choose from.
We'll also be chatting about his love of Eurovision. I'm thrilled to have Donal Skean in with us today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. This is very exciting.
Yeah, well, great to be here. Great to be here, of course. It's great for me to be here.
I'm glad you're here, and I'm great to be here too.
I'm going to jump straight in. You released your most recent cookbook, Home Kitchen, last year, which I think was your 11th cookbook.
Yes, yes.
Obviously, congratulations. That's amazing.
Thank you.
How would you explain the book to people that haven't yet bought it?
So it's been, I suppose, over the years, my cookbooks have become more kind of autobiographical in some ways, because they always fit a purpose and a stage of life. And Home Kitchen was born out of the fact that we had just found our forever, I hate saying forever home because it just sounds so twee, but our forever home. We've been living all around the world, and we've had this moment of just kind of coming home. And I suppose in lots of ways, it was trying to find that collection of recipes that spoke to my family and spoke to other families. And we have two young kids, 4 and a 6-year-old. So we have, our kitchen works differently than it did 10 years ago. And so the recipes that I rely on are far more important than ever before. And so, and I suppose in lots of ways, they form the memories and the essence of what family life is for us. So Home Kitchen is a collection of those recipes, but it's also doable recipes. And I think, you know, over the 11 cookbooks, and I suppose if you have a cookbook, that's probably my go-to, is that they're doable recipes. They don't feel, you know, too difficult. There's aspirational elements of them, but they're very much, I could get into the kitchen and give this a go.
Yeah, absolutely. I was reading Home Kitchen, and they're so vibrant, the recipes, but also, like you say, they almost feel like they shouldn't be achievable because they sound so exciting. But yeah, when you're actually doing it, they're really easy and I think very accessible to the home cook.
I'm glad you got that from that, because yeah, I do aim to try and find the little success moments in the kitchen. I mean, those things, those ingredients in the pantry, like harissa paste, you you know, fennel seeds just dry fried in a pan and then ground. Just those little pops of flavour that are quite, I suppose the everyday home cook might not reach into that pantry and kind of go, oh, I must use them. And I like to highlight those ingredients in the recipes just to bring a little bit more life. And I suppose more than anything, I see a lot of people who maybe have never cooked before, who maybe are first time cooks, who want to get that great moment of success when you've gone to the effort. And like for a lot of people, cooking is a big deal and it's problematic. If you don't know what you're doing, it can feel like a big monster to take on. But my aim is always to try and make it as accessible as possible and to find those little moments of success, those little moments that when you sit down and go, it was actually all worth it.
And I think for a home cook as well, like if you're cooking for a family, sometimes it can be quite daunting because you're like, oh, I've got to cook again. And also, oh, do I go back to my repertoire of five recipes or do I try something new? Mm-hmm. I think there was a gochujang fried rice, I think, in the book. And yeah. I just thought that's such a great idea because fried rice is quite a simple dish, but actually to try some, you're adding in a new flavour that people might not be that comfortable with yet.
That's it. And I think we all hear of these ingredients that, you know, and for Korean people, gochujang is like a second language.
Yeah.
But, it, you know, it is one of those sort of ingredients that I think we're seeing much more prevalent nowadays here in our kind of modern kitchens. And I think that's important. Like I've always had such a great love of travel and I've had such a love of other cuisines that kind of weaving them into my recipes has always been a key element. And I think, you know, they're the ones I come back to. They're the ones that I really rely on for that. Because I think that drudge of, and I've only kind of been introduced to that drudge of the daily dinners for kids. Not that they eat gochujang because it's too spicy, but there is that element of, you know, you need to have those little kind of moments, those pops of colour and vibrancy in your everyday cooking that just elevate it and make it interesting not only for the cook but also for the people you're cooking for. And you know, even with young kids, I think there's plenty of opportunity. I say all this, there's plenty of opportunity to bring inspiration to the kitchen, but I say all this having made spaghetti bolognese the other night and they polished like two whole bowls of it. I was like, for God's sake, no, for all the effort I go into, spag bol is still like, it is still up there.
At least you're not saying, well, we eat gochujang fried rice but they have beans on toast.
Yeah. No, I will always, and actually one thing, you know, particularly for kind of cooking with kids, I will always, no matter what is on the table, I tend to bring everything to the table and offer it, because there is that moment where you're kind of going like, they're just never going to be interested. But like we often go to, there's a fantastic Korean restaurant called Arisu in Dublin, and you know, whenever I can bring the kids in, and they love it because it's the novelty and it's the opportunity to try new things, and I love having the opportunity to be able to kind of expose them to different flavours. And even when we were living in Los Angeles before, I think our first job was only two at the time, but we would often eat out, and we'd eat out quite a lot more than we do when, since we've come back to Dublin. And because of that, you know, we were always trying new foods and there was always something to kind of excite and interest. And I do try, now that we are back home and I do have to cook the dinner every bleeding day, there is, you know, that idea to try and kind of, you know, make it a little bit more exciting and try and make it more interesting.
Well, and you mentioned LA, so were there a lot of differences in the food scene there? The only thing I can picture is that you would never walk anywhere and you would just drive everywhere, but that's just from watching the TV show.
Yes, and I think that's the problem, is that there is like this massive misconception when it comes to Los Angeles, particularly as a tourist, because I think it's a very hard city to get your head around when you arrive there, because as a tourist you probably think of Venice Beach, Santa Monica, Sunset Strip, and beyond that there's probably not much else from a tourist perspective that you kind of might go and explore, maybe Griffith Park and go up for a hike or something. But what we found from, we were living there for nearly 5 years, and in living there we were actually kind of based east of LA, near Pasadena in Glendale. We were in a little town called Eagle Rock.
Ooh,
and what was lovely
exciting.
About it, the name alone Eagle Rock, it was not as exciting as you might as the name might lead you to think. It was quite a like sleepy little town, but I remember getting an Uber out to this little town, and it wasn't, so Silver Lake and Echo Park were the kind of the foodie hubs at the time.
Okay.
So this is probably 2015. And subsequently, Eagle Rock and Highland Park were the kind of next evolution of that, but it was just at its infancy. So it was a lovely time to kind of live there, because, and I remember there's a great cheese shop called Milk Farm, and they have, like, they imported stuff from Neil's Yard, and
oh,
they
wow.
had fabulous, like, American producers as well. So I always think if there's a good cheese shop in the neighbourhood, you're probably onto a good thing.
I'm seeing this on, like, Selling Sunset now. They're just taking you to the house and then taking you to the farm, the cheese shop, going...
Yeah.
oh, what do you think?
Oh, look at this.
Yeah this will do it for you.
It would do it for me anyway. And, you know, down that row, and as things evolved, like there was a vegan Thai place. There was a great coffee shop where I actually wrote three cookbooks, found coffee. So, like, I think that was the thing, is that you find, to sum up what I'm trying to say, is that you find your LA bubble. And when you find your LA bubble, you'll find that there's restaurants, there's people, there's interesting aspects to it. And I think it's very much I suppose it's not a centralized city in the way that we might think of Dublin or London. And the amazing thing is, from a food perspective, is that there is just this incredible amount of different cuisines to choose from. You've got the San Gabriel Valley, which has the largest Asian population outside Asia, which leads to phenomenal food. Like, there was an amazing Sichuan restaurant called Chengdu Taste. There was literally dumplings. You could get anything you wanted, and really great Vietnamese food. And I think what was interesting about it was that the restaurants weren't like super high end. You were able to kind of go to mom and pop shops and get and spend not very much money to go to a strip mall and get a really good, you know, Vietnamese summer roll or a bowl of pho. And I think from that perspective, I just got so excited. So every weekend was spent. I used to live on this website called Eater LA, and Jonathan Gold, he was this fantastic food critic who used to write for the LA Times. I actually met him once in the Hollywood Farmers Market, and he only passed away a couple of weeks after. But it was just this kind of voyage of discovery when you got to LA. And I think that was the thing, that, like, you could, you know, I suppose in London and in Dublin, there's like a hot spot and everyone goes to it.
Like Soho.
Exactly.
London,
But this was a sort of city that you could kind of uncover your own. We used to go to this unbelievable, before the Hollywood Farmers Market, very early on a Sunday morning, you could go, and there was this Thai breakfast place called Siam Sunset, and you'd get these beautiful big bowls of rice porridge, or you could get like a rice soup, and they would do Chinese donuts with condensed milk, and you could get your, you know, beautiful Vietnamese style coffee and with condensed milk. And that's the sort of thing I miss the most of it, not living there. So it's an incredibly diverse food scene, and I think that from anyone's perspective who does go to visit, take your time, make your list, and go and find those places, go to them. They're just, it's a fantastic city to explore.
It's really interesting listening to you, because I feel like, on television or watching like the obvious, you know, Netflix shows, I feel like you don't get that sense coming across. And you do see the fancy restaurants, and you see, like, you know, them going out for lovely drinks and stuff. But it's so interesting to hear about, like, the farmers markets, the cheese shops.
Yeah.
And so, like, going back to your books again, after you'd be on your 12th book as your next one, obviously, if you want to give us an exclusive, we'll take it. How do you work out, like, what you're going to write about next?
Well, actually, the hardest part of the last couple of years has been that travel has kind of, the frequency has lowered, not only because of COVID, but also because of a family life and the kids needing a little bit more structure in the week. I say that sitting in London and...
You've just travelled here.
But no, I mean, I think that has had an impact on it, and it's not as easy to kind of jump on a flight or go somewhere. And there's probably, I do less of the sort of travelogue TV series that kind of I would have informed a lot of the sort of cooking I was doing.
Okay.
So in its absence, I suppose I have leaned in very heavily to the sort of recipes that I know are functional for my family life and also for other families who are in the same position. Coming back to the family classics has been one thing. I mean, we've seen the rise of air fryers and slow cookers convenient options when it comes to dinner. And I suppose in lots of ways that has always informed how I come up with what's next. And I'm working on the next version of, or the next cookbook already.
Yeah.
And I will give you a bit of an exclusive, because it comes from making a lot of television shows.
Okay.
And I spend my life, when we're making television shows, if there's a recipe that marinates or has to sit in the fridge or has to be in the oven for an hour, or every time you do that when you're making a television show, you have to stop for at least 15 minutes or half an hour. So it completely stops production. Everyone has the opportunity to have a chat and all that. I want recipes that are straight through cooking. I want recipes that are simple. I want recipes that while you're cooking your pasta, you've got a sauce on the go. So I think that's the next iteration of what I see my kind of cooking to be. Because it is, you know, I'd love to tell you that my life allows for slow cooking and roast goose and whatever, you know, fancy food. But ultimately, it is. Like, I mean, I laugh because I was doing spag bol the other night, going, "Oh my god!" I used to give out about my mum making spag bol because that was her go-to, and like you'd come home and you'd be like, "Oh, spag." I sound so privileged now. Oh, spag bol again, mum. But no, it is that element of like you do need those recipes that are reliable and that are convenient. And so, 100 variations on spag bol. That's the exclusive. You've got it here now.
There'll be many people buying that.
I'd imagine so. Yeah.
So when they're like their kids or their partner complain, "Oh, is it spag bol again?" You go, "Well, yes, but actually, you've not tried it this way before.
You haven't had it with a splodge of harissa paste or a side of chorizo. That's what's missing."
But I think that kind of that theme almost goes through everything you do, because I think even back to your like original books, like Good Mood Food and Kitchen Hero, like they were also about sort of helping people cook and about making it, or breaking down the barriers to cooking, if you know.
Yeah. Well, I think that, I mean, I always kind of, in the early days, I was kind of reticent to say that, like, I'm not a chef. Like, I am not.
Sure.
I don't come from a restaurant background. I started because of my love of food and because I loved cooking. I grew up with cookbooks. I grew up with watching Delia Smith and watching my mum cook. My grandmother was a fantastic cook. And, you know, my grandmother probably is where the trickle down of food comes from. And my mum was a great cook. My aunt trained at Ballybaloo, and she's a food stylist. And so I always grew up with it. I never thought it was going to be what I would end up working with. But because of that, I think when I come to kind of sharing recipes, it comes from a really true place. And I think it's not, you know, it's not to make money on selling a dish to a customer. It's very much about, I want to be your buddy in the kitchen who's, we're making great things together. And I think as cheesy as that sounds.
I don't think so.
I think there is an element of that, you know, that idea that it always comes from, what are we going to do that is the most productive, that is going to give you the best results? And I have always, and I suppose as time has moved on, I've had a very clear vision of who I write recipes for. And because of that, I think that's why the recipes kind of tend to do well. And social media has formed a big part of that. I came from the original food blogging world. That was when the Pioneer Woman and Matt Bites, I remember, and Smitten Kitchen, I don't know if you remember, Dan.
Yeah, blogging was huge, wasn't it?
Blogging was the thing in 2006, 2007. And what I loved about it was that kind of feedback that you got. And I suppose that has informed my career in all aspects, because I've always put recipes out there and got instant feedback. And because of that, I suppose what I would say about that is it can be a dangerous game, because I do remember finding myself in the YouTube world of making like one pot lasagnas.
Oh, wow.
And going, oh no, we've reached the other side. And I think you have to be self-conscious enough to kind of go, no, when it's enough and we need to find substance again.
It's like everything had to be one pot, and then there was that moment where everything had to be small. Like, remember, like mini fish and chips.
No, I didn't have time for that. I was over in LA when that began, and I remember one of a food stylist I worked with was one of the hands who did all those mini recipes.
Wow.
And she was fabulously talented, but like, what is that about?
I don't know what that was. It's like, you want a canapé, but you also want shepherd's pie. So just put it on a spoon.
Yeah, that but was it was that. Even smaller than that. I don't know if you remember. It was almost like food for mice. And it was like a tiny, anyway, nonsense. But I think that's the thing that you have to kind of, and I suppose in terms of like longevity as well, you have to look at the substance of the food that you're cooking. And, you know, even I mentioned throwing chorizo into a bolognese. There has to be substance and a reason to do that. You know, if it's not going to be there for a purpose, or, you know, and there is, I do live in a world where I'm okay with a little bit of blasphemy in Italians' eyes, because I have done a one pot pasta that Martha Stewart originally made famous, and then my one got, I think, 9.1 million views on YouTube.
Wow.
But the comment section alone was like a cesspit of.
Was it 9.1 million Italians telling you that that is not real pasta?
No, and threatening. I think there was some death threats in there.
I'm scared of it, but I also kind of, I'm sort of proud of them for protecting their pasta.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, and the interesting thing was, I had been in Italy at the time, and I was filming a series called Grandma's Boy. So I was actually in Italy when it all happened. And I just remember going, all these people on the internet who say if they ever met me, I'm really worried. But thankfully, nothing ever happened. But you know, working and seeing what Italian people are like when it comes to food, it is, it is inspirational in terms of the passion they have for Italian food. So no, it is, it's a positive. I think we should be checking ourselves when it comes to the recipes we're creating.
And I think you go over there and just the food, the way, how much they care about it and the passion for it, and the fact that, you know, if you're in northern Italy, you buy a drink and they'll give you a platter of food because that's how much they love to show off what they make.
I always laugh because there was a moment where we would go to the different regions that we were filming in, and you'd land and a local guide would pick you up, and you'd get about halfway through the conversation and they'd be like, "This, we're famous for this and we're famous for this." And without fail, every single person in every single region would go, "And of course, we are best known for our incredible extra virgin olive oil," which is like what we are now. I was like, "I'm not going to let them know that your man up the road said his extra virgin olive oil." And you could only be like an hour and a half away and they'd still talk about their extra virgin olive oil. But that's, you know, that is a that is pride
absolutely.
In place.
Have you ever spotted McDonald's hot, crispy fries right as they're being scooped into the carton? And time just stands still. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
Want to be more active this summer? Sierra helps you save on everything from swimsuits to stand-up paddle boards, tennis rackets to fishing tackle. And if that doesn't float your boat, we also have pool floats. Sierra, let's get moving. To your local store, like now. Go!
Now, you mentioned that you weren't a chef.
Yes.
And you actually, sort of before you entered the food writing world, you were actually a pop star.
Yes.
A number one chart-topping pop star in your band.
Best-selling, I think, is the word you're looking for.
No. Award-winning, Grammy-nominated.
Not Grammy-nominated. I wish.
How did... First of all, I just would like to know how you became, like how that you entered that world in the first place, but then how the transition happened as well.
Okay, so interestingly, I was working in a music TV station at the time, and because I was writing showbiz gossip at the time, I was bored out of my mind. And that's when I started, I think it had come out of the time, I had just moved into my first house out of the family home, and I was cooking so much, and I loved, you know, myself and my girlfriend and then now wife had just moved into this lovely little apartment, and we were cooking all the time, and she hadn't really seen me as my skills as a cook that I'd grown up with, and so it was on full show, and maybe I was showing off a little bit, but I started cooking so much that I started this food blog as a sort of an out from writing about Lindsay Lohan and Britney Spears.
I can see how that can become traumatic.
It was peak that time of the world, but no, so that was the kind of, I suppose it was this other world that gave me an opportunity to kind of do something that I really loved. And the music TV station I had worked with, and the manager, the guy who ran the company, he was looking to start this band as well as I had been. And I had been in the Eurosong, which is for the Ireland's choice to select the Irish Eurovision Song Contest the previous year. You know, highbrow stuff.
Yeah. And, we'll be talking about that later.
And I got beaten by a hand puppet who is the equivalent of Ed the Duck.
Okay.
And unfortunately did not go to Belgrade that year in 2008, and did not get to pass go, did not get the £200, and ended up setting up this other band off the back of it with people who could actually sing, because
No puppets
and people who could actually sing, and so we had this amazing run of about a year where we supported the Pussycat Dolls, we went number one twice, we supported JLS, we performed in the O2.
Blimey.
We had these incredible moments, and it was like a taste of this world. But I always knew while we were in it that my true love was food. And I do remember I was writing Good Mood Food, which you mentioned, at the same time I was in that band. And I remember us all going to a signing down in Cork in Ireland, and they had to have the windows closed, no air conditioning, while I was on the phone dictating edits for this cookbook. And they were all like, "What is he doing? Why is he writing a cookbook? We're obviously going to take over the world.
We're trying to break America.
Amazing pop songs." Exactly. Will you just stop it? So so that all kind of coincided at the time, and the music world kind of stopped. And I always knew. I mean, it was like, you know, it's the pop world. So like,
it's very fickle, isn't it?
It's very fickle. It changes very quickly. And we had... a specific manager in Ireland who took a disliking to us.
Oh, no.
And our sights set on the UK were put to bed very quickly.
Okay.
Yeah, so that we'll say no more about
Did
that.
Did you not think, oh, I'm going to use my showbiz gossip journalistic skills and I'm going to write a little and story about this person?
It was before exposés were ever a thing. We were all shtum and, you know, it was
just
quiet.
I think about the pop star world sometimes. You see it, or like you read about it all the time, and I think, gosh, it must be
cutthroat.
Hard.
It was cutthroat. Yeah. I remember we had our showcase for like our new music, and all these amazing journalists, all these great people, and it had turned out that someone had said that they weren't allowed to write about us because because they would take other stories away. But anyway, that's another.
Well, we don't do that another here one. At we, Good Food.
No, there's none of that in the food. And actually, what I would say is that the creative element of producing recipes and working in this world is so much nicer than the old pop world.
I can imagine. I mean, for many a reason, I will never have a taste of the pop world, but
Never say never, Sam.
The food world is very friendly.
I think, mostly.
I think it's a very nice place to be.
It is.
Because
it
everyone's
is.
Passionate about the food.
Well, we can all sit down and share a common value. And I
yeah,
think that's
exactly.
Definitely something.
Yeah, I completely agree. Now, you mentioned the Euro song, Eurovision theme. You're from Ireland.
I
hope I'm right in
You're
saying
right.
that.
Yeah, I don't know if and the accent gave it away.
I thought it was Scottish.
Oh, Jesus.
And your wife is from Sweden.
Yes.
And does that ever, because you love Eurovision.
I love Eurovision,
yeah. Does it ever cause any kind of friction?
No, because I have massive respect for Sweden's incredible reputation in the Eurovision. And the interesting thing is, having married a Swede, is that like, you know the way like UK and Irish people kind of look down our nose at Eurovision? I had to go to Sweden to find a wife that would allow a straight man to like Eurovision and
I thought you said I had to go to Sweden
for who he is.
I had to go to Sweden to find a wife.
That too. So from lots of respects that, you know, Sweden takes Eurovision very seriously. It's why, you know, they are now tied with Ireland in terms of our many wins. And no doubt we'll take over because they have it down to a fine art. And, you know, it's an amazing competition that has evolved so significantly
and
over the last few years.
It's just full of so much joy, isn't it, really? It's much like cooking.
Much like cooking. And if you can cook and have a Eurovision song in the background, I mean, that's my happy place.
Do you have a dish that you would serve at Eurovision or that you go to for Eurovision parties?
This is how obsessed I was with Eurovision, because I grew up and my best friend, he loved Eurovision and he is gay. So this has been really helpful because he has been the person who has made it a little bit more acceptable to like the Eurovision growing up, and certainly
didn't turn you away.
He didn't turn me away. So he and I used to run these Eurovision parties for my parents' friends, and we would cater. And so actually, this is how far back the cooking element goes. And I used to make my aunt, like I said, my aunts have always been a big inspiration when it comes to cooking. And my aunt, who had lived in the States, she used to bring back these incredible cookbooks, these back of the packet cookbooks.
I know,
and I love them.
Some
and
great recipes on
some
there.
Well, you do have to kind of go through the Coca-Cola and like the 7-Up cakes and things like that. But you're right, there are some fantastic keepers. But once you've trawled through, and there's this fantastic cocktail meatball recipe, and it's like a 70s vibe. You use tin soup, you use brown sugar, and you use lots of Tabasco sauce.
Yeah.
And you make this basically big pot of meatballs that are cocktail meatballs. And so you have them at parties. And so we used to do these catered events for my parents' friends when I was only like 8 or 10. And maybe I was a 10 or 11. I don't know. Anyway.
But young, you were young.
Young. And we would fleece them for money because we'd know who was going to win and we'd have a good sense of what songs would do well. But so we'd get them in, get them fed, get some booze and then fleece them for the money. And so, it was a well-oiled machine.
And will you be going to Sweden this year, isn't
this
it?
Year,
this
yes.
year, yeah.
The plan is to go to Sweden.
To go.
Yeah.
To Malmö. Is it Malmö?
Malmö, yeah. We're very disappointed that it's not in Gothenburg. So my wife's from Gothenburg, and it would have made the accommodation situation just a little
cheaper.
Bit easier.
Yeah.
You know yourself.
I'm going. We're
Are
gonna
you?
Stay in.
Are you?
Yeah, going to stay in Copenhagen. Is that right?
That's a good call.
Bridge. Yeah.
Yeah. I'll be honest now, having spent a bit of time in Malmö, Copenhagen's the more happening city.
Yeah, I just thought it might be more to do.
There is. And it's only, the amazing journey is across the bridge, the actual bridge.
The bridge from the TV show. Yeah. I've watched two seasons. I'm quite pacing myself.
Okay. Well, when you go, I hope there is isn't any murders.
It might
halfway
be me
over.
On the bridge, yeah. Half on one side, half on the other. Well, you mentioned the new cookbook or the yes. cookbook you're working on. Is there anything else? Any other projects?
So we have a production company called Appetite Media, and so we make my TV show, but we also make a show for Chef Nico. We make a show for a guy called Mark Moriarty, who's who used to work in a Michelin star restaurant in Dublin. So I've really enjoyed the process of I love project based work, and so the production side of things is really fascinating to me. Coming up with those concepts is really interesting, and I suppose what takes up a lot of my time is the creation of that social media content as well. I mean, I think you see it so much now, where there's reels and recipes, and I write for the Irish Independent, so I have a weekly food column that I photograph and write. There's just a lot of plates, and I really enjoy having a lot of plates and moving. And of course, this morning I come over here. Yeah. The reason I'm here is not just for you. I mean,
no,
I'm sorry, about
not
that, Sam.
For you.
It's in addition to you. I also come over and do this morning like twice a month, and I've been doing quite a few travel logs for them. We've been to Wales and I've been to Texas.
Very varied there.
Very varied. Quite different. So I've been loving that, and really love working with the team there, and the fun we have is great. But yeah, keeping busy and trying to stay relevant, you know yourself.
Yes, yeah, I can understand that. And I think very much with social, it's ever changing, isn't it? So you've really got to keep on the ball.
You do, yeah.
I didn't mean to ask about Eurovision, actually. I mean, it's hard because no songs have been released, but are you're gonna go for Ireland as the winner?
Ireland actually has a good chance this year. Yeah. So I am very opinionated when it comes to Ireland's track record over the past few years, because having been in the Eurosong myself, I will tell you that the last time they actually made an effort was probably the year I was in it, where they had a national final with a big stage. The UK are taking it more seriously as well.
Yes, they are.
So it's positive.
Yeah.
But Ireland has probably one of the best chances. We have an entrant called Bambi Thug, and it's kind of somewhere between Lordi, the Finnish monster rockers, and I don't know, goth pop.
Okay. I mean, the name Bambi suggested something different then for a minute.
Bambi Thugs.
Thug does suggest some kind of aggression.
Name. Exactly. So no, look, at Eurovision, you have to make a bit of an impact. And I think this song has the ability to do that.
Absolutely.
I'm glad we've gone down this rabbit hole. I thought you'd just come and talk about food, but you talked
like
about my other
passion. Well, I like to mix it up a little bit. Because I'm gay and I came to Eurovision late.
Yes, okay.
And felt that I didn't used to like it very much.
Interesting.
But now I love it. But probably because my partner loves it. So yeah, I think people would assume I love Eurovision.
That's a recent thing. I had a lot of that growing up.
Yeah.
love of Eurovision.
So you love Eurovision, you must be gay.
I was it's the minority that is not represented. The straight camp men who love Eurovision.
well, we'll leave that one there.
Yeah. you don't know where to go next.
No,
is that not in your notes?
Oh, that's not on my little chart of where to go after that answer. I feel like I'm at a call centre where it says...
I'm obviously joking.
We always have a section which is my favourite dish,
which
is, as it suggests, we talk about the guest's favourite dish. So what would you say your favourite dish was?
Well, as I mentioned, I love Korean food, but I have to... When people ask me this question, I have to think of like what my food kind of stems back to, and I suppose it is the Irish roots, and I absolutely love... And the thing that kind of brings me the most nostalgia is a really gorgeous Irish stew. I grew up with a very specific hatred of potatoes. I don't know what this was as an Irish child, but I think it was because the potatoes were so prevalent. And so Irish stew obviously has potatoes in it. And so I would eat the carrots, I would eat the lamb, I would mop up the juices, but the potatoes were always left on the side. So my Irish stew is kind of more, it's got that sort of cobbled potato. So
Layers.
Yeah. So what I do, if you have like really nice lamb shoulder chops, or you have that nice bit of fat, you cook them out, you add your... you add your carrots and you add your onions. And I know they're not the traditional ingredients, but I like them that way. And so when we make ours, we do it like that. We cook out the lamb. And then towards the end of the cook time, I'll cobble the potatoes over the top, add a little bit of butter, and you get these kind of beautifully steamed from the underside potatoes with a little bit of texture and a little bit of browning over the top. And ultimately, it is my most... I think probably a desert island dish. It is one of those things. My dad used to, when we were kids, do you know what a sliced pan is?
No, but I'm going to find out.
Okay, so yes, you are. So because sometimes I say things in England and I don't know if it's an Irish thing or an English thing. But yeah, so a sliced pan in Ireland is like your bog standard, like a hovis.
Okay. Oh, like a loaf.
A sliced tin. Loaf, yeah.
Oh, it's not a pan at all.
No. Well, it's
of
made
course,
in a bread.
Pan, like a pan loaf. Exactly. Not a pan. I'm thinking saucepan.
Yeah, so sliced pan is what I think a lot of Irish people will call like your regular bog standard sandwich loaf.
Yeah.
But my dad, in a very unglamorous way, would always butter lashings of butter on a sliced pan and mop up the juices of an Irish stew. And it's probably the most unceremonious way of eating an Irish stew, but it is probably one of the best.
My dad does the same thing.
Does he?
With a stew, yeah, he loves mopping anything up like that with it.
I think it's a dad thing.
Yeah. I think it's great.
It is. And I mean, like, that, I do think I always do get asked that question of, like, what is your favourite dish?
Sure.
And it's so hard to answer, but I do think I always try and stem it back to the sort of thing that kind of informs where my food origins are, and the nostalgia.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And I guess with that, you've got the because of the lamb, there's going to be a fair bit of fat.
Yes.
And then the potato just sort of soaks it all up, and then crisps at the top.
It's so good. And I like, because that's the other side of it. When you cook the potatoes within the stew, they just kind of
they can collapse a little bit.
They're
can't
just anemic
they?
And a bit miserable. Whereas if you put them on the top of the and you take the lid off the casserole and pop it in the oven with a little butter, it really gives them that.
How often do you make the dish?
I actually make Irish stew more often than you'd imagine, because it is that sort of, like I said, it's nostalgia. And so I often find myself making it towards like September, October as the weather changes, around Halloween time. I actually make a lot of traditional Irish food around Halloween because it is that Irish festivity. And I think, you know, it's a lovely time to celebrate. Also around St. Patrick's Day, I think there is a bit of, I don't know, that Irish patriotism.
Is that big in Ireland?
Oh, yes, it is. Interesting. I don't know if you were aware of this, but the Irish Tourist Board had this global greening campaign where there was monuments around the world greened, basically.
Okay. When you said green, I immediately thought sustainable.
A global
but actually,
greening.
Actually, you mean literally colouring.
Just lighting. So the opposite of sustainable, just lighting things in green.
Flying somewhere and turning it green.
Yeah, exactly. So I think we're getting a little bit better at kind of maybe celebrating the more important sides of the festival. And food is one of those wonderful things that Irish people do have. And I think we're coming back around. I remember working with the Irish Food Board many years ago where we kind of, if you Google Irish food, it's populated by like awful American images of like grey, miserable
Irish
dishes.
Stew,
Irish,
often.
Yeah, really in, bad yeah, photos yeah, of Irish yeah. stew. And you know, I think the interesting thing is that firstly, we have much more passion for our ingredients. We have much more, you know, I think Irish food has just come on leaps and bounds. Like the restaurant scene, the food is fantastic, the quality of the produce. And so all of a sudden, we have this newfound respect for Irish food. And as a result, when it comes to the traditional foods and cooking them, I think, you know, you're not getting slop on a plate. You're getting beautifully presented traditional foods and foods that should be celebrated.
And even the way you're, you know, talking about your Irish stew, it's completely different, really, to how the traditional one is, like,
well,
say.
It's like the Italians, and if you don't do it the traditional way, you will likely piss someone off. But I actually, so there's a recipe called Dublin Coddle, which, okay. I don't know if you've heard of it, but basically it's kind of in the vein of an Irish stew, but nothing gets cooked. It just gets all put in the pot and boiled. So it's like, it's coddled. It's slowly cooked.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, one of the ingredients with a Dublin coddle is a sausage.
Okay.
So you end up with a stew filled with nude looking sausages that are floating in liquid. And so I, in my great wisdom, decided that I'm going to like make coddle sexy by browning some sausages. And similar to my one pan pasta dish, I got quite a lot of Irish hate for browning my sausages. Irish people like a nude sausage in a coddle, and I'll say no more.
Who are you to change
Who am I to change the coddle?
Well, we're going to move on to confessions now. And the first one was biggest cooking disaster.
Ah, yes.
And I wonder, maybe it was the coddle.
The one-pan pasta, the one-pan lasagna, the coddle. Let's add to the list. My worst cooking disaster, probably because the stakes were so high, was around Christmas one year. And often in our family, we divvy up the job. So rarely does it all fall on one person. And, you know, because my family are good cooks and my aunts are always up for the task, we all get given something to do. And so my job that year was to do the ham. And I do a good ham. Okay. I do a lovely plum and star anise Christmas ham baked to perfection.
Very
lovely
nice.
And glossy and red because you're using a plum jam. But this year I decided I was going to cook the ham and I was going to let it slowly cook while I go out for a walk. And I miscalculated the timings. And you know, like that Christmas is stressful enough.
Yes.
And then you add to the timings and all that sort of stuff. Anyway, I got the timings wrong and basically made a pulled pork. And and so
still good for a sandwich.
I mean, great for the sandwich. Not so much for the centerpiece of the Christmas dinner that everyone was lying. And considering the job that I do, you know, the expectations are quite high. So anyway, there was a rush to, unfortunately, like the butcher's closed at this point. And so there was a rush to the supermarket. And no one was any the wiser that I managed to pull this off. Everything. The dog got a really great dinner that day. And yeah, ultimately, that was my worst cooking disaster. But as the great Julia Child will always have pointed out, you can always save it from disaster, from the
you
brink
can.
Of disaster.
Absolutely.
I always reference that moment where she's making an omelette on live television and
yes.
it flops all over. And she just uses a spatula.
Love her.
And that is the skill of a true home cook. You have the ability to keep the show on the road
Keep
no matter what. Keep calm.
Well, that leaves me into my next question, which is, have you ever served something ready-made and pretended you made it yourself? Well, was the ham ready-made and you pretended you made it yourself?
No, I had to go back to scratch and start again. Anything I've... I don't know that I have. I'm sure if my friends would be listening to this, they could give you examples, but I can't remember any that I'd be willing to share. I am a big fan of cheating with ready ingredients. So like a stuffed pasta, no problem in my books. Store-bought gnocchi, things like that, no problem. And I think, you know, when it comes to getting dinner to the table, I have no shame. And look, I think we're in a place where the quality of ingredients you can buy from a supermarket are at a pretty good standard that, you know, adding a brown butter and some sage to some gnocchi and like, I am done. That is fantastic.
And you're still making it yourself, kind of.
Kind
right?
of,
I
yeah.
think so.
We'll tell ourselves that. But no, I don't think there should be any shame in food in general.
This is obviously not a thing to be shameful of, but have you got any foodie guilty pleasures?
Yes, many, many. So like, obviously I'm all about the quick cooking, but I can tell you on a Friday night in Ireland, in Howth, where I'm from, the Dragon Boat gets a call, which is our local Chinese takeaway.
I'm liking this
and it's for one reason only, and most Irish people will know that the new, forget the lamb stew, forget the coddle, forget all the traditional foods, there is one dish, I don't think it's made it to the UK yet, but it's called a spice bag. And if you haven't come across a spice bag before, it is practically our new national dish. It is a Chinese Irish concoction of a takeaway classic whereby they mix together chips, crispy shredded chicken, onions, peppers, and what is known as the five spice seasoning, which is basically a mixture of sugar, salt, and I think basically five spice.
Five spice.
And essentially it's coated with chili, and it's probably, it's like the Irish version of a Scottish deep fried Mars bar. It's indulgent, it's ridiculous, and I talk about not having shame when it comes to food. There's a little bit of shame when the lady hands the bag across the door and it's me, the fella who cooks on the telly, and I'm picking it up. But no, look, you got to embrace it. And I actually won an award for my last cookbook.
Yeah.
And celebrated because they had cancelled the event because it was COVID.
Oh, no.
And so I had a bottle of champagne, a spice bag, and sat with my award for the night. That was, you know, living my best life.
Do they have that moment? I think it was in Sex and the City where she phones up and without even having to place the order, they're like, will that be a spice bag? Spice bag.
We are definitely at that stage. I used to have this thing where I couldn't answer the door because it was me and I was off the telly cooking. And so my wife would always answer the door. But now I don't care.
There's no shame.
Takeaway is one of the great treats in life.
Absolutely. Right, we have got our quick fire question round now.
Okay.
So we try to make sure they're quick fire. Okay. Sometimes we fail, but we're going to try and we will hopefully succeed. What's your favourite kitchen job?
Prepping the vegetables. I like a little system where I have my bowls for prep and a bowl for scraps, and I rock through all as much prep as I can.
I love that. What did you have for dinner last night?
What did I have for dinner last night? It was, unfortunately, spaghetti bolognese.
Love that again. I mean, there should be no unfortunate about it.
Ah, I'm sick of spaghetti bolognese.
The kids were happy.
The kids were really happy.
What's your favourite sandwich filling?
This is quickfire. I'm terrible at quickfire. What's my favourite sandwich? I don't know if this counts as a sandwich, but after living in LA, a breakfast burrito. I love a breakfast
burrito.
It's
a breakfast sandwich, isn't it?
Yeah, with a dip in hot sauce. So good.
Best kitchen tip you've ever been given?
Everyone talks about peeling garlic and all the different... Forget about the tips. All you need is to take the end off the root and then give it a smash with the back of a knife and you will get the skin off your garlic. Forget about shaking it in a jar or any of the other things. Just do it the classic way. That's the best tip I can give you.
What do you listen to when you're cooking?
Oh, I listen to lots of things. I have, as you might imagine, a very eclectic mix of music. So I love Eurovision, love the Europop, but I also love classical. I have the thing for kind of 70s music, and I also love podcasts. So River Cafe, I love Ruthie Rogers' River Cafe podcast. But yeah, a wide variety of things I listen to.
Do you ever listen to any of your own music whilst you're cooking?
I tend to listen to my own music in, like, it's a road trip song.
Okay.
You have to be in the car to listen to Industry, My Baby's Waiting. It's a roll down the windows, let your hair down kind of song.
What's your most trusted recipe?
My most trusted recipe, probably my mum's roast chicken and really good potatoes. Gorgeous. I do kind of pan fried carrots as well. Just simple stuff that really is homely and hearty.
Do you think is the most overrated food?
Well, I was going to say licorice because I hate licorice.
I hope your wife's not listening to
this. I know. Well, it comes from my wife because my wife loves salted licorice and it's a very Scandinavian thing.
Yeah.
I absolutely hate that.
What do you think is the most underrated food?
Well, I think Irish food is most underrated. I mean, I think we have... probably some of the best produce in the whole of Europe, in the whole of the world, but Irish food in general needs more of a spotlight shone on it.
Worst thing you've ever eaten?
Worst thing I've ever eaten. I do remember when I was in the band, we used to have to travel around, and so like just grim petrol station food where there is zero option, and yeah, the soul has been sucked out of food in petrol stations.
Ultimate comfort food.
Ultimate comfort food is anything pasta. I love, love, love pasta. And I really enjoy cooking it as well. So as a comfort food, it never feels like a chore, and it's something that I will happily sit down to. Cacio e pepe. Beautiful.
Eurovision, Sweden or Ireland?
Oh, I'm sorry, Ireland. We just have not been in the race. We've not been at the races. It's Sweden. Sweden are killing it.
And our final question, which is not quickfire. What makes you optimistic for the future?
Ooh, that's a very deep question. I think I've always been, as I mentioned, I love projects. I love setting big goals and setting those big dreams. And so that's what kind of drives me. And, you know, I love the idea of bringing projects to fruition. So, and a cookbook is a perfect example of that, because you have the concept, you have the idea, you have to pitch it, you have to, you know, package it, you have to photograph it, you have to make the recipes work. You know, there's so much to it. So I really enjoy what I do, and I really enjoy that aspect of it. So I think always looking forward to what the next project is what keeps me going.
That's lovely. Thank you so much. And thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. It's been lovely to be in this very fancy studio.
Thank you.
With you, of course.
Of course, thank you. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Good Food Podcast. Join us next week for exclusive interviews recorded at the Good Food Show in Birmingham. First up will be Becky XL and Paul Ainsworth. Don't forget, our bonus cook-along episode is out on Thursday. For more recipes and inspiration, please visit goodfood.com or download our app, which will also give you access to exclusive and ad-free podcast episodes.